This is Eleanor Swent continuing the interview with Frank Jockvic in Salt Lake City, Utah, January 22nd,
1994.
Okay. And go back just a speck. This is September 1988, the opening, and it had been raining, you said, for 3 weeks.
For 3 weeks before, and lo and behold, on the morning of the 23rd of September, the heavens parted. There wasn't a cloud in the sky. It was possible to have an outdoor gathering outside the smelter. About 800 people attended, and lunch was served. Good time was had by all. Governor Bangida cut the ribbon, and Bob Horton spoke. And I think Patrick Gillam of British Petroleum. I have, and John Jump of British Petroleum. No, I don't think he spoke, but he was there. But the interesting thing was that there was an air of confusion, of uncertainty amongst our visitors, amongst the BP people. And maybe my memory's not quite correct about that, but rumor had it that that morning an agreement had been reached by BP to sell Kennecott to RTZ. Here were these canned speeches being given about the long-term future and BP's commitment to the mining business and to Kennecott, and I have a suspicion, it may be incorrect, that some of these executives had received word that morning, or perhaps had even made decisions to sell Kennecott lock, stock, and barrel to RTZ. Anyway, it was a great day. It was a big milestone in the long history of Bingham Canyon, and everybody felt good about it.
Oh, it must have been terribly exciting to you.
Yeah. Now, one thing I should say, we had come to the conclusion that we should keep part of the old concentrators working for two reasons. One is that we had whipped about 30,000 tons worth of capacity through Bonneville and Magma into pretty good shape, so that the costs were attractive. But more importantly, that, and I've totally neglected to say that in this account, that copper prices had begun to pick up in the latter part of 1987, and a year later in 1988, had already been up over a dollar from the floor of 50 to 60 cents that the prices had bumped along at for the preceding 3 or 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
Let me tell you how this came about. During 86 and 87, gold prices had risen, after their sharp decline from the $800-odd level in 1980. And gold exploration throughout the world had blossomed, mm-hmm. had picked up tremendously. And the stock market had picked on gold as its favorite commodity for speculative investment. I'll have to talk about that separately. And we had for some time been promoting the idea of floating off a gold company, the nucleus of which would be the Kennecott gold discoveries that were made in the early 80s, that I'll talk about a little bit later. Well, the potential underwriter of such a gold float was going to be Solomon Brothers. And Solomon had, working for them at that time, Peter Ingersoll, who's justifiably regarded as the guru on metal price forecasts. And we were having a meeting in Salt Lake with Solomon Brothers to discuss this gold float. And the meeting was already underway when Peter Ingersoll arrived from New York I don't know whether he'd flown overnight or whatever, but he was a little bit disheveled, and he pulled out of his pocket a crumpled piece of paper and started talking about the strong likelihood that copper prices would pick up before the end of the year. This was in the summer of 87, I guess. And we, as the Kennecott people, we found this very interesting. His colleagues in Solomon, who were interested in discussing the gold flow, couldn't really care less about what he was saying about copper. But Peter's one of those guys that, you know, if he feels that something is worth saying, he will go ahead and do it. And he had a very strong rationale from the supply and demand projections that he had on this scrap of paper there, that finally the crunch had come, that finally inventories had come down to the below 6 weeks consumption level at which historically always prices reacted. Well, it made sense to us. The only thing is he then talked about as an additional factor was the rising AIDS epidemic in Zaire and Zambia. Well, at that stage, he really lost the audience of his colleagues, and there was some merriment expressed that this could really be regarded as a substantial factor in reduced copper supply, as it's actually turned to be. I mean, Peter was dead right. Mm-hmm. Anyway, he put this together, and the rest is history. Prices did indeed rise to the from 60 cents to 70 cents, and then by the end of the year, had by the 15th of December, had reached $1.30 a pound, and Kennecott, from losing money at $20 million a month in December of 87, was making money at the rate of $20 million a month. Mm-hmm. I mean, a breathtaking turnaround. And relating this now to the completion of the modernization project, everybody thought we must have been brilliant to start this project when we did and come out and hit a major rise in copper prices right on the nose with the completion of the project. So that, of course, added to the very festive atmosphere that prevailed at the opening. And it also throws light on why the continued operation of Bonneville and Magma, which came to be known as the North Concentrator subsequently, was viewed favorably. And what we did, therefore, was to maintain in the pit a couple of reload points at which trucked ore was loaded into the few remaining or onto the few remaining railroad tracks in the pit, hauled through one of the upper tunnels all the way to Bonneville for crushing and grinding, and then flotation at Magna with a processing rate, a throughput rate of 30,000 tons a day. And this has continued since then, is projected to continue till the end of mine life. Mm-hmm. As an adjunct to the 77,000 tons a day plus being put through the Carbon concentrator. Before I go on to the discussion of the smelter, cover of the UCD smelter project, and harking back on Chino for a minute, I should say this, that a lot of people were nervous about having one conveyor supply the feed to Carpeton through a 2 mile long tunnel. They thought that this link in the operation was too vulnerable to be relied upon, and we got over that by supplying essential, by having adequate stockpile storage ahead of the concentrator, which is one of the most spectacular features of it, the gantry with the conveyor, and then the shuttle discharge onto the stockpile, and three tunnels withdrawing the ore from stockpile. Incidentally, the design provides for an additional tunnel which was used for the fourth line at Carpeton, which I'll talk about in a minute. The fourth line was in our original design. It wasn't an afterthought. But talking about the vulnerability of this lifeline from the pit to the concentrator, it reminds me of Chino, where the new crusher on the edge of the pit was connected to the coarse ore storage at the concentrator by a conveyor mounted on a trestle a distance in excess of a mile. And in August of 1985, Pam and I had reached the stage where we hadn't had a vacation in several years, and decided we just had to have a little break. We had friends in southern France and went to the Côte d'Azur at a place called Saint-Raphaël. And we'd been ensconced there for several days when I it was late in the afternoon and we had a few friends into this very attractive apartment on the beach where we were staying, and I forget what prompted me to do it, but I decided to call Ruby in the Salt Lake office. And Ruby picked up the phone and said, guess what, the Chino coarse ore conveyor has just collapsed. And I said, Ruby, this is not really a very good joke on your part. You know, we're busy here having a good time, we'll talk to you later. And she said, wait a minute, I said, I'm deadly serious. It has just collapsed.
Mm.
So I got the details, and apparently the night before, the bulldozer operator concerned with cleaning up around the stockpile at the end of the coarse ore conveyor, in the moonlight, thought he saw the trestle sway, and sure enough, the swaying increased, and the whole structure came crashing down, and very fortunately, he managed to avoid it. He went home and had a drink, and when it's officially recovered, he sounded the alarm. And the operation, of course, came to a grinding halt. Mm. And that was the end of my sojourn on the pleasant beach there, and the windsurfing and so on. And I got a plane back and met with the boys in Phoenix, I believe, where we had found a contractor who could produce the steel necessary for the repairs in some incredibly short space of time. And with Ward Wimborne, one of our most experienced and best maintenance people, to ramrod the project, we had the conveyor up, rebuilt and up and running again in short order, in about 30 days. That was a great feat. Apparently the cause of the collapse was simply rusting of some joints, and consequently and rusting before welding could take place in the construction, a function perhaps of inadequate inspection at the time. But for those who wanted to draw a parallel between that and the conveyor through the tunnel at Bingham Canyon, fortunately, to the best of my knowledge, there have not been any interruptions due to either conveyor failure in the tunnel or what we feared equally, perhaps some kind of shifts due to seismic or other reasons, and partial collapse of the tunnel itself. We've been spared that. The fourth line at Bingham Canyon
talking about the fourth line.
The fourth line at the concentrator was the first project that we presented to our new owners, RTZ, who, true to my suspicions concerning the completion of modernization ceremony at the site. Indeed, substantive talks had taken place, or perhaps had been concluded at the time, and RTZ...
Did they take only Kennecott? They took BP, didn't they?
They took BP Minerals, of which Kennecott was by far the most important component.
Okay.
So this was the first request for funds. We came to the board, at least not the board of RTZ. RTZ had a, perhaps still has, a different system where operating company managers do not have contact with the board, but instead of that report to a executive in London who then takes the project to the board. Now, I reported to Bob Wilson, who later succeeded Derek Birkin as managing director of RTZ and has that function now. So the presentation was made to an executive committee in London on December 18th, 1989, and I guess Bob took this to the board. Now, that was actually the date on which he took it to the board, and that was the date the $227 million project was approved. Now, as I've said, we had that fourth line in the original design of the modernization, so it shouldn't have come as a surprise to RTZ. What did surprise them, and I admit us a little bit, was the cost. Mm-hmm. And what it implied was economic recovery had indeed taken hold in this country and to some extent throughout the world. There was a lot more construction activity. The competition for equipment manufacture packages and for construction work at the site was not nearly as intense as it had been during the modernization, and there had been general price escalation of in substantial proportions. The fourth line included a 36-foot sag mill with a wraparound motor of Siemens design. There had been others built in the world or installed in the world, I believe in connection with the iron ore industry, and one in Chuquicamata. I think that was the first one installed with the in the copper industry. This mill had significantly larger capacity than the 34-foot sag mills already in place. It was coupled with two 20-foot diameter ball mills and, of course, with new flotation capacity in the concentrator. Dennis Connell had succeeded Raman Rao as our Vice President, Engineering and Construction. Raman had chosen to take retirement for health reasons. And the project went ahead and was completed in I'll have to fill that in. Again, ahead of schedule and within budget, and has performed admirably right from the beginning. The throughput capacity is of that fourth line is 35,000 tons a day, so that total milling capacity with 77,000 tons a day plus at Copperton, 30,000 at the north concentrator and 35,000 on the fourth line is 142,000 ton a day, and you can round that up to 150,000 tons a day with the improvements that have occurred since then. And Kennecott's capacity to produce copper in concentrate increased to a total of 300,000 tons of copper per year.
Staggering.
Yeah. Shall we call a halt then so that you can...
I think perhaps if that's...
Sure.
We're continuing the interview on January 22nd in Salt Lake after a luncheon break.
The next segment of the modernization of Utah copper facilities was the smelter and refinery. And at the time when RTZ bought Kennecott from BP, which was in April of 89, a team came over to do due diligence. We had known the RTZ organization over the years, of course, as competitors, and we knew some of their people. I'd met Sir Alistair Frame, the chairman, before, and had considerable respect for his technical and business acumen. He was also a very personable man, and spending time with him was a pleasure. RTZ prided themselves on operating with a small headquarters group in London, less than 200 people. And this was understandable in light of the fact that most of RTZ's worldwide interests were partly owned, had strong local management, and boards, albeit many of them with the majority of RTZ directors. And there was therefore not much call for duplicating all the functions that existed at these partly owned entities in London. At our first meeting with Alistair Frame and Derek Birkin, who later succeeded Alistair as chairman of RTZ, Birkin emphasized the, quote, devolved management style of RTZ. And this again made sense because of the self-sufficient nature of the member companies of the RTZ group.
Was this greatly different from BP?
Well, that's a good question. To be quite honest, it wasn't really very much different. BP didn't avow to running their company in a particularly decentralized manner, but they really did so. They didn't just make a big issue of it, but there was a good deal of reporting to headquarters with BP, but there wasn't much top-down management from mm-hmm. headquarters. In retrospect, perhaps with RTZ, it was different in that the official management policy was one of decentralization. But in effect, as time went on, we find that there was quite a bit of management involvement. But that really only came because Kennicott was the first major wholly owned entity of RTZ.
Hmm.
And they found this to be a new experience, I think, and one in which they could modify their management policy as time went along after Kennicott had been owned for some time. But one consequence of the small headquarters group there in London was that the group was thin technically. Mining industry, for one thing, and the second, technical people, especially with major project experience, were scarce.
Hmm.
The due diligence of Kennicott, the due diligence examination, therefore, wasn't done in as great depth as might perhaps have been imagined. So when it came to looking at the smelter, I had discussions with both Alistair Frame and Derek Birkin at that time concerning the likelihood that the smelter might have to be replaced, totally rebuilt. Now, I certainly didn't talk in terms of the capital numbers that eventually were developed. I think we talked in terms considerably less than that, but the principle that the existing smelter might not be the solution to the operational and environmental problems that the existing plant was experiencing that should not have subsequently come as a surprise to RTZ management, because it was discussed from the outset. Similarly, and I'm jumping ahead a little bit, a project that was facing Kennecott at the time when I retired in May or in June, was the expansion, was the necessity to expand the tailings pond, which occupies an area of 10 square miles on the shore of the Great Salt Lake, on the south shore. The tailings pond had attained a height of, I believe, in excess of 175 feet. And we knew that in consideration of stability under normal conditions and conditions of seismic acceleration, it would not be wise to go very much higher than, say, 200 feet. And with an addition of 7 or 8 feet a year, one could see just when it was likely to have a expanded or a new tailings pond facility. And this was certainly apparent from the documents that were furnished at the time when the due diligence was done. This tailings pond expansion is another item, capital expenditure of the order of maybe $500,000, and this is yet to come, and clearly there's no return on an investment of that nature, but it is a vital link in the operation.
And may I just ask one question? You said that their management was thin technically, but they certainly had, I mean, it was primarily a mining company. They had plenty of technical expertise at their command all around the world, didn't they?
In the companies, right, like CRA, right, and so on. But this was an investment by RTZ, not by CRA.
But they couldn't borrow a technical expert from one of those other, one of their other entities?
It was entirely up to them. That was their call, not ours.
No, but I'm surprised that they wouldn't.
I don't want to make a big issue of that, in that one might have expected a company of that size to, descend with a swarm of technical experts, but that wasn't the case, which was perfectly understandable in light of the fact that RTZ, as I say, at the time, was perhaps more of a holding company than anything else.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Another, just as an aside, I quickly got the idea that they appreciated the cost reduction exercises we'd been through, because compared to the oil companies, Standard Oil and BP, they seem to be wont to operate in a much more frugal manner.
Mm-hmm.
The people we met from the outset were clearly cost conscious, and just their modus operandi was different. Both Standard Oil and BP had a fleet of corporate aircraft. I have never been one who felt that maintaining corporate aircraft was essential in a land such as the United States, where there's a commercial airline network second to none. Naturally, there are often remote sites where chartering an aircraft is a very worthwhile thing to do. But to fly corporate aircraft on standard runs between Cleveland and San Francisco and New York, or as happens sometimes, I believe, to Super Bowl games, was not in accordance with the way that RTZ operated, and I was pretty happy to see that, because we, after the lean years of the 80s, and me personally just by inclination, we were not inclined to do anything but watch our pennies. Mm-hmm. It was our customs and custom, and we felt uneasy when such custom wasn't observed. Once the purchase of Kennecott by RTZ had been completed, we began a study of the options facing us in the smelter and the refinery. The study examined the alternatives of refurbishing the existing smelter and trying to bring its capacity up to somewhere near its rated capacity of 1 million tons a year of concentrates. But in its condition at that time, it couldn't do much more than 700,000 or 800,000 tons a year under the most favorable circumstances. The principal reason being the problems they had with operations of the Naranda reactor, of the Naranda reactors that were installed in 1973-74 during the partial rebuilding of the smelter that I already talked about. The Naranda technology was the recommendation and the brainchild, I believe, of Nick Themelis. And as I said before, the expectations that ultimately one would have a one vessel operation in which both smelting and converting would take place turned out to be over-optimistic. And the maintenance of the reactors, the fairly short campaign life, the difficulty in maintaining refractories in adequate condition even during the relatively short campaigns was a constant source of worry. The rebuild of the reactors between campaigns was always more costly and took longer than expected. In other words, the Naranda technology was not something that we could point to with any pride.
Had it been successful, obviously had been, I guess, successful in other places.
Well, I don't know. The only place that I was familiar with Naranda, as it was Naranda,
Naranda.
The one smelter, and I guess they had reasonable
different,
success with it. Otherwise,
different chemistry?
Otherwise, no one would have dreamt of using their technology, but I guess you're right. I think they were dealing with different concentrates to which the system was more applicable, perhaps. Mm.
Costly mistake or costly exercise.
It was. It was indeed. Yes.
And yet this was a very recent thing. You said 70s.
Yeah, that was in 73, 74.
Mm-hmm.
During really environmentally mandated rebuild that I talked about before. The study was concluded in April of 1990, and right there and then recommended that the best solution to our smelting bottleneck was the scrapping of the existing smelter and substituting an smelter with Outokumpu flash smelting technology, and the preliminary cost estimate was $1 billion, which caused a mild state of shock with the with management, but it further studies just didn't come up with any better solution. There were some environmental considerations driving us at the same time, particularly the state was implementing a new plan for the control of fine particulates, the so-called PM10 particulates. Particulates less than 10 microns in diameter.
This was state of Utah.
Yeah, state of Utah. And the following year, new SO2 standard was promulgated by the state. Both of these, of course, under the guiding hand of the EPA. We recognized that the that ultimately the cost of supplementing or rebuilding the existing smelter to meet the emission standards mandated by these two state implementation plans would be prohibitive, in the sense that the operating cost to be expected from such a facility then would not be much different from what we were experiencing at that time. So despite a capital expenditure of great magnitude, there would be very little return on the investment. All the time, we took into consideration that the Utah copper operations were in a pretty unique situation in being smack up against a burgeoning community with already a population of 1 million people spreading in the direction of the operations. And that if we took any measures that would only satisfy environmental standards for a relatively modest period of time, we'd only be shooting ourselves in the foot. We said, if we're going to spend real money here, we better build something that's going to be absolutely state-of-the-art and serve the operation for the rest of its life while easily meeting whatever requirements the adjacent community might make on us in terms of pollution control. So, the preliminary engineering of this new smelter was designed to achieve the lowest achievable emission rate, commonly known as LAER, and to meet the 1991 and 1992 state implementation plan for fine particulates and sulfur dioxide. We decided to marry the Outokumpu flash smelting technology with the continuous converting process developed and patented by Kennecott. And through this continuous flash smelting and converting technology and the use of air enriched with oxygen, we believed that the need for fossil fuels would be minimized and that concentrated SO2 off-gas would be produced that could be converted to sulfuric acid with minimum escapes of the off-gases. The design called for capture of 99.8% of the sulfur in the concentrates versus the 93%, which is about the best we could do with the existing smelter. We reduced, in the design, we reduced the SO2 emissions from 4,700 pounds an hour to 211 pounds. And the SO2 emissions per ton of copper produced are estimated at 6 pounds per ton of copper, which is one-third of the Tamano smelter in Japan, which is currently the cleanest in the world. What helped, of course, was the open-air ladle transfers of molten copper from the smelted to the converter was eliminated with Kennecott's continuous converting technology. The concentrate smelting capacity would be increased to 1.1 million tons a year, which will take care of all of Kennecott's copper in concentrate production, including the fourth line, and even allowing for some further expansion. Energy savings, the new smelter will reduce, will require only one quarter of the energy currently used to produce a ton of copper. And when it comes to the economics, the costs of smelting per pound of copper are expected to be reduced from over 20 cents a pound which the existing plant's running at, to the order of 10 cents a pound, cut in half. And in addition to that, of course, you save the freight on sending virtually half of the concentrates currently produced to smelters elsewhere in the United States and overseas. So it wasn't difficult at all to make a good case economically for the new smelter, to say nothing of the environmental considerations.
I'm sorry, you lost me on that. Saving shipping concentrates overseas, you were shipping?
Well, at the moment, half the concentrates are being shipped for smelting elsewhere because
I see. Okay, because of the increased capacity.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
All right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Was there any organized, how organized were the environmentalists here? Did you have Sierra Club and people like that?
Oh yeah, but not so much, mm-hmm. really. You see, in the promulgation of the particulate standards, a lot of finger pointing went on in this community as to where they were coming from.
Mm-hmm.
And you had wood-burning stoves in homes. You had finger-pointing at Geneva Steel down in Provo. They tried to make a case that in Kennecott the off gases at the smelter, at the SO3 generated, which is what forms the visible plume from the smelter, that this was converted to sulfates in the atmosphere. Now that was a pretty tenuous argument, I thought, and that this contributed substantially to the particulate pollution in the wind in the valley. Mm-hmm. You know, we do get inversions in the wintertime.
Mm-hmm.
And so some studies were made by us and by the state agencies, and what came out of it, of course, was what we had anticipated all along, that by far the most important contributor to the particulate problem in the valley is not Kennecott or Geneva or the oil refinery here. It's automobiles.
Population.
We're at the intersection of north-south, I-15, east-west, I-80, and it's the traffic on the freeways every day that causes the particulate levels to rise above the standards mandated. And I have a suspicion that even after the Kennecott smelter's completed and even after Geneva cleans up their act and the oil refineries do something, we'll still have the problem, and something fairly drastic may have to be done about the emissions from automobiles.
And population, of course, is growing all the time, too.
Yeah,
enormously.
And you know, in my observation, any true environmentalist, and I've always objected to the term environmentalist applied to such people. I remember when I took over president of Kennecott, I was interviewed by Bob Woody and others. They asked me, well, who I was and so on. I said, I'm an environmentalist. And I said, for one who spent 12 or 15 years in the mountains and the deserts and the backwoods and so on in the world, I am better acquainted with Mother Nature than most people, and I love it. And I'm the last one who would willingly do damage to the environment. The self-styled environmentalists are often extremists, and if you ever say to them, that perhaps they should curtail use of their automobiles. They quickly tend to drop the subject.
Oh, yes.
Oh, yeah. So we had a press conference here in Salt Lake where the governor and we announced this $880 million project in the construction of a new smelter and the refurbishment, if you like, of the existing refinery to repair what needs to be repaired and to expand it somewhat to match the capacity of the new smelter. This is an investment of about $80 million, if I remember rightly, about 80 out of the 800. And $80 million goes into the refinery to updating the tank house, do a modest expansion so that if the smelter is capable of producing 310,000 tons of copper or blister copper a year from Utah concentrates, the refinery is capable of producing the same volume of cathodes.
Did you imply that RTZ people had been surprised by this, that they had not anticipated this?
I would say that Sir Alistair Frame wasn't surprised. I remember riding between meetings with him in New York on one occasion. This was maybe a year after the acquisition. And I said to him, you know, you've seen what we have and what we do. What do you think of the future? And he just turned around to me and said, Frank, the first thing you better do is build a new smelter.
So he certainly knew.
But I think perhaps the technical people hadn't anticipated that the present smelter really had its day, nor I think had they, and for that matter, we were surprised too by the eventual cost estimates that came out when some more detailed engineering had been completed.
So this is not completed yet.
Well, the smelter project was approved by the RTZ board on November 20th, 1991. And then on March 11th, 92, we held this press conference here at which we announced the project, and by its magnitude, of course, it made a big splash. And we were gratified to see in the paper next day comments by representatives of some of the environmental agencies, I believe the Sierra Club, I may be wrong, but there were favorable comments by the environmental groups.
They could hardly complain about it.
Well, you know, there had been some who'd said, oh, you know, Kennecott shouldn't be smelting in this state. They wanted absolute purity, and you know, the argument that, my heavens, you know, you sacrifice all those jobs, the value added. You transfer those jobs elsewhere, mostly overseas. Think of the, you know, just the people, the human side of it and so on. And, you know, some of the extremists say, well, that's all right. You know, this planet would probably be a much better place without humanity. You know, you get that kind of argument. So, fortunately, we didn't have any such absurd comments, and the project was greeted for what it is, namely a great environmental benefit. It's well underway now. The engineering was completed, of course, I believe early last year, early 93. The contractors chosen for the project were Davy, and Fluor, for the smelter, and Bechtel for the refinery. And the smelting technology, process technology, was supplied by Outokumpu.